This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Jim Lawler was a specialist in the recruitment of foreign spies. He spent well over half of his CIA career battling the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Jim was chief of the AQCON nuclear takedown team, which disrupted the most dangerous nuclear weapons network in history. At the time, Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet wrote, "What you and your team have achieved will rank up there as one of the most spectacular intelligence accomplishments in the history of CIA. Not only are we taking down a network, we're disarming a country." Deputy Director of Central Intelligence John McLaughlin noted that the effort was the closest thing he'd ever seen to a perfect intelligence operation. For his work, Jim received CIA's Trailblazer Award, a unique honor given to a very few CIA officers. We'll be right back with Jim and this fascinating story after a quick break. I'm Andy McCreadis, and this is Intelligence Matters. Here's a message from my colleague, Michael Morrell, on Flare.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
Jim, it's great to have you on the show and to reconnect. We've known each other for close to 28 years, as you pointed out to me the other day. And in true CIA fashion, even I don't know all of the work that you did. So some of what you tell us today will be new to me, too. But before we get into that, I really want to ask you about being an author of spy novels. Your first book, Living Lies, a great read, is a thriller about Iran's nuclear program, something near and dear to my heart, as you know, Jim. And your most recent book, In the Twinkling of an Eye, is about Russia, North Korea, and biotech turned into a weapon. I think good fiction like yours is a real art. So can you briefly tell us how you got started writing and what it's like to write a great spy story?
Andy, I have had a desire to write a novel for a long time. In fact, in one of my interviews with the CIA back in 1979, before I joined, my interviewer asked me if I had any ambitions, you know, long-term ambitions. And I said, yeah, I'd love to write a novel. And he said, damn it, that's all we need is another author in the CIA. And I said, look, I want to write fiction. And, you know, I'll agree to the fact that all of my books have to be cleared by our publication clearance review board. But I just think that maybe being able to tell a good spy story is something that allows creativity. And now that I can't practice operations in a actual sense anymore, I kind of like to live through my characters vicariously because I was really passionate about my career. And the notion of writing Living Lies started back in 2015 during the negotiations between the United States and Iran, which resulted in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is a real mouthful. But in essence, the United States was going to agree to ease sanctions, provided that Iran would cease a lot of its uranium enrichment activities and allow international inspections. And I remarked to my best friend, Rolf Moat Larsen, I said, that's all fine and good, but what if they cheat? And so I constructed a novel, which is in essence a reverse of the WMD situation we had in Iraq, where the United States was convinced that there must be a WMD program in Iraq, and there wasn't. But in this case, we have an administration in my story that is increasingly convinced that Iran truly wants a rapprochement, wants to have peace, wants to stop their nuclear weapons program. And the administration becomes overeager to conclude a successful negotiation. At the same time, the Iranians send a double agent from the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard at one of the delegation's members, and he feeds them false information, which tells the United States that Iran has stopped its nuclear weapons program. And in fact, 99.9% of what this double agent tells his handler is true, which is always the best double agent material that you can get, the truth. But the part that he's holding out is that a senior IRGC general, an Iranian, actually the nephew of the new Ayatollah, is conducting a very secret nuclear weapons program covertly hidden in Mount Damavand, which is only 45 miles from downtown Tehran. Mount Damavand, by the way, is a fascinating place in Iranian history. It's almost like their Mount Fuji, although it's actually 6,000 feet higher. It's over 18,000 feet, and it's a semi-dormant volcano, only 45 miles from downtown Tehran. And so they locate a secret facility in this dormant volcano, and a very talented CIA officer and a very talented FBI special agent individually recruit some sources inside of the Iranian program, and they try to convince the administration that there truly is a secret nuclear weapons program in Iran. And most of the senior management at CIA is ignoring this, in spite of the fact that that the agents are telling us the truth. And so it continues to build with factions within the agency. One small faction saying there, in fact, is a WMD program, a much larger faction, which says that there is not. And then it finally ends in a rather explosive situation. I don't want to steal any scenes.
Like I said, it was a great read. And I guess you're working on another one, right?
Well, right. After I wrote that one, I did one, as you said, on the biological weapons program, North Korean-Russian conspiracy. And I'm working on a third one, The Traitor's Tale, which is about treachery. It has very little WMD content in it, which was my specialty at CIA. But it has everything to do with what motivates espionage and what causes people to betray a trust, because that's essentially what I had to do for my 25 years at the agency, was to convince people to commit treason against their own countries or against their own organization. And so this subject of the emotional ways that people become involved in espionage is near and dear to my heart.
So Jim, that's a great lead in. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your career at the agency?
Well, I interviewed with the agency first in 1976 when I was in my last year of law school. And like anybody, I was trying to find a job, you know, in my last year of graduate school, law school. And the agency came to campus interviewing for attorneys for the Office of General Counsel. So I went to this interview, and the interviewer, a former case officer named Bill Wood, he, after about 2 minutes of conversation, he asked me if I'd ever considered joining the clandestine service. Now, this was 1976. We didn't even have a sign out on Dolly Madison Boulevard. All it said was Federal Highway Administration. And I said, well, I don't know what the clandestine service is. And he says, well, Jim, you ought to think about it, because I think you'd be good at this. Well, unfortunately, my wife's mother at the time was very ill, and there was no way we were going to move to Washington, much less overseas, thousands of miles away. So I just took his card and went into a family business where I was making a lot of money, but not especially happy. In fact, I was very frustrated because it was truly meaningless. And so my mother-in-law had passed away, and 3.5 years later, I continued to come home every night and complain about how frustrating this job was. And my wife said, Jim, either do something about it or stop complaining. And so I did. I went in my office, I wrote Mr. Wood a letter, and 3 days later, I had a phone call. And the young lady said, Mr. Wood received your letter. Could you meet him next Thursday at 3:00 at the Holiday Inn on the Gulf Freeway? And so I went to this interview. He talked to me for about 2 hours, said he wanted to fly me to Washington. I did. Went through about 3 days of testing. Came back 3 or 4 months later. They invited me to come back for a few more days of testing. The polygraph, the shrink exam, everything. And shortly thereafter, I received a phone call asking me to join the agency in February of 1980, and I did. Now, the crazy thing, though, Andy, was I had no idea what they wanted me to do. We didn't have, you know, back then there was no internet. There was nothing describing what we did. And so I joined the agency, truly not knowing what an operations officer did. But then I found out. And I found out that it meant that I was to manipulate people, exploit people, subvert people, suborn people, to convince them to betray a trust, to commit treason. And I found out that not only was I pretty good at it, but I enjoyed the hell out of it for my 25 years.
That's great. So why don't we just sort of start talking about the heart of today's discussion. And that's AQ Khan and your role in the takedown of his network. You know, it's been said that no other person in the last half century did more to proliferate nuclear weapons technology than AQ Khan. So can you tell us a little bit about who AQ Khan was?
Yes. To set this in context, Pakistan's mortal enemy, India, had detonated a nuclear weapon in 1974. It was called Smiling Buddha, supposedly a peaceful nuclear explosion. Well, this did not go over well with the Pakistani government, and the leader at the time, Ali Bhutto, said that they would eat grass if they had to, but they were going to get a nuclear weapon. Now, Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan, AQ Khan, had received his PhD in the Netherlands, and he was working for a consortium of the British, the Dutch, and the Germans called Urenco. Now, Urenco had perfected ultra-speed, high-speed centrifuges, which basically took uranium from a 0.7% uranium-235, which is the fissile isotope of uranium, up to about 3.5% to 4%, which they then used for peaceful nuclear purposes, powering nuclear power plants. But if you take that same plumbing, that same ultra-centrifuge, and you just hook more of them together in what they call enrichment cascades, you can then approach whatever is needed for a bomb, and that varies depending on how much mass you have, but it'd be somewhere north of, say, 85%. And you can then produce the fissile material, the uranium-235, for a nuclear weapon. Well, he saw that Pakistan was struggling in its efforts to develop its own nuclear weapon, and so he volunteered to basically steal the plans for the uranium enrichment cascades, the machines, the ultra-centrifuges, and take those back to Pakistan, which he did in the late 70s. He basically took the designs that were Urenco designs and then left. His brilliant idea was, though, to leave a network of co-conspirators in Europe, not fellow Pakistanis, but Europeans. And so they would then supply the actual materials he needed and refine designs to him over the coming years. And he established what was initially Engineering Research Laboratory, and they named it after him after a few years, Khan Research Laboratory, because he essentially gave the Pakistanis a nuclear weapon.
So when did Western intelligence agencies really become aware of Khan, and what were the initial concerns?
They became aware of Khan in the late 70s. There was actually a source or two that knew what he was doing. They basically tipped the Dutch service off, the Dutch authorities. The CIA was following this to a vague extent, a certain extent. And people have sometimes asked me why the CIA didn't take more of a role in this. I really don't know the question to that. I was overseas at the time. But if you remember, in the late 70s, we were distracted by Afghanistan. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. There were a lot of things going on around the world. And as much as we'd like to think that the CIA can be everywhere and do everything, we can't. We have to focus on priorities. And focusing on Dr. AQ Khan simply wasn't among those priorities at the time. And yes, we were aware that he was stealing designs. You know, the Dutch had told us, I believe, that he had stolen designs and was going back to Pakistan. But we really didn't put the resources against him at that period.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. You know, if you look back, I mean, the security at Urenco, which is the Uranium Enrichment Corporation, which is a consortium that you mentioned, was pretty lax, it sounded. You know, he could take documents, papers, designs. He could wander around the entire facility and get access to things that today you would not allow to let happen.
Absolutely. In fact, all these designs are what we call restricted data. In the United States, you have to have a Q clearance, an atomic clearance, in order to see these things. And they're very strictly regulated. But you're right, Andy, at the time, regulations were loose. And as I said, they even had a source. It was a co-worker of Khan's who knew what he was doing. and complained that this isn't right, because they knew this was sensitive stuff. If you take these centrifuges, you put a few more centrifuges there, you take it from low enriched uranium all the way up to high enriched uranium. It's just a matter of plumbing, as one of my physicist friends said.
So Jim, let's get into some of the details here. You know, how did the U.S. intelligence community and CIA specifically see the threat? Did we go to Pakistan either diplomatically or to their intelligence service, ISI, with our concerns? And how did they react to all that?
I don't know historically if we, I doubt that we, so as long as Khan was doing this for Pakistan, for their indigenous program, I'm sure that had we complained or said something to the Pakistanis, they would have basically told us in no uncertain terms to beat sand. I mean, just leave it alone. But what we didn't know at the time, until the, I'm going to put this in vague terms, let's say the mid to late 90s, was that Dr. Khan had gotten very ambitious, and he no longer was content to be the father of the Islamic bomb for Pakistan, but he decided to take proliferation private. And this was something that the world, or at least the CIA, had never seen. We had had state-to-state proliferation, where one state, for whatever geopolitical reason, would provide weapons technology, WMD technology, perhaps to another country. But we had never, the United States had never seen, nor had Great Britain ever seen, a private proliferation network. So I had a couple of very bright analysts, I won't mention their names because I believe at least one of them is still undercover, who was aware of a project I was running at the time, which had a WMD target in mind, but a different target. And knowing that we were in the same, area of operations as some other things that were going on, these two analysts brought to my attention the fact that it appeared that there was some outward proliferation coming from Pakistan to some entities we'd never encountered before. And so after some good human intelligence investigation and some very good technical investigations, we discovered that Dr. Khan was proposing to take proliferation private, to provide nuclear experience, nuclear plans, everything you need to some rogue countries such as Libya. And that was stunning, absolutely stunning.
Yeah, so Jim, you know, I guess we can't, you know, we shouldn't, you know, underestimate this, that having a worldwide network that was not state-sponsored was a new concept, right? It was, you know, it was before Al-Qaeda, which, you know, was a worldwide terror network and others. So, you know, the idea of dealing with a non-state worldwide network that was proliferating or doing things that were dangerous, we didn't quite get our hands around it right at the beginning because it didn't exist before.
Well, you know, this is the quintessential black swan. This is something we had not seen before, and we were taken aback. I mean, we were so taken aback that when I talked to a senior DO officer who headed our Near Eastern Division, I said we had early indications that Libya had a nuclear weapons program. And he looked at me with contempt and he said, Jim, if Libya had a nuclear weapons program, we'd know about it.
Yeah. So let's talk about Libya here in a second. Who were the players? Who did Khan sell to?
Well, Libya was certainly number one. There have been indications he tried to sell to Iraq. We know that a lot of his designs were used in Iran, so I guess he must have sold to Iran as well. But this was all just Dr. Khan. In fact, I briefed President Bush on this fairly early in the operation, and his first question to me was, is President Musharraf, the president of Pakistan, is he aware of this? And I said, Mr. President, to the best of my knowledge, he's not. This is just totally Dr. Khan. Dr. Khan was in such a unique key position that he could do whatever Khan Research Lab was named for him. I analogize by saying, you know, if Henry Ford wanted to supply something dealing with automotive technology, who at Ford Motor Company is going to stop him? And so that's what he did. He was supplying this. And there was other parts of other customers that he was considering past Libya.
North Korea?
Yes, he had a lot of things to do with North Korea. I think he was key to providing North Korea with uranium enrichment technology. Up until then, everything was based on a plutonium bomb. And so, yes, I'm sure you're right, Andy.
And so that you know, the challenge that you just mentioned, you know, he was sort of revered in Pakistan as the father of their bomb, even though he technically wasn't, but that was the moniker he had. And so pretty tough for anyone to sort of challenge him internally.
I jokingly say, let me tell you this, if AQ Khan had run for president of Pakistan, he probably would have won. I say, you know, he's kind of like George Washington, Robert Oppenheimer, and Elvis all rolled into one. He was so revered. They had statues of this guy. He had public relations people on his payroll to continue to fan the flames of his fame and everything. And he probably even coined the term father of the Islamic bomb. I mean,
he probably did.
He probably did. I mean, yes. The guy was a narcissist with an ego that was just huge.
We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back with more of our discussion with Jim Lawler.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
We mentioned Libya and the deal that Khan made with them. We just passed the 20th anniversary of Libya's voluntary WMD disarmament. So can you talk a little bit about what Khan was supplying to Libya?
In short, everything. It was a turnkey thing. The plans for uranium enrichment to produce the fissile material. He had somehow procured the uranium hexafluoride gas, which he used to feed the feedstock for the uranium enrichment thing. And then the clincher was he also provided them with the complete diagrams for a 14-kiloton nuclear weapon based on the Pakistani atomic bomb, which had been there. They had obtained the plans from China. These were proven designs. The Chinese design had been tested. The Pakistanis tested the bomb themselves in 1998. And so we had a proven design. He provided them everything you need. I mean, it was a turnkey sale, basically, from start to finish.
So, Jim, was the disarmament and then our subsequent discovery of Khan's ties to Libya the beginning of the unraveling of his network? Had that already started as Libya was disarming, or where are we in the timeline here?
It was almost contemporaneous, Andy. I mean, we knew we had to take down the network, and so we had to, you know, use some what we call, I don't know, what does CIA specialize in? Humint, SIGINT, you know, a blend of all these things. And so my project used a blend of all of these things. We obtained some impeccable sources inside of the network and developed the intelligence. And then we basically were going to assist with what was going on at the time. Very few people knew this, but Libya had approached us through the British and was wanting to normalize relations. I think Muammar Gaddafi had seen what was going on with Saddam Hussein. I think we were about to invade Iraq, and fearing that Libya would be next on the list, his intelligence chief, Musa Kusa, had approached the British, which then they approached us, and said, what would it take to normalize relations? And the American position was, you have to get rid of your weapons of mass destruction programs. Gaddafi said, fine, then that we're going to do that. Unfortunately, that did not filter down to his negotiators, because our negotiators were met with a complete roadblock on the issue of a nuclear weapons program in Libya. They said, we have no nuclear weapons program, simply a peaceful nuclear reactor at Tajura in Libya. That's all we have. Well, we were wondering, why are they stonewalling us on this? So due to some, all I can describe it as, some impeccable sources, we were able to then learn that a ship called the BBC China had 5 40-foot containers loaded with nuclear components on it. And we were able to chat through some sources with the company which owned this BBC China. It was in Germany. The German government helped us. And the shipping company then ordered the ship's master to divert to the Italian port of Taranto in the southern part of Italy and offload these 5 40-foot containers filled with nuclear components. The ship then proceeded on to Tripoli. Our negotiators were meeting at about that same time with the Libyans. The Libyans once again stonewalled us, claiming that there was no nuclear program. And that's when, I believe it must have been Ray Richardson, one of our key nuclear negotiators, said, then how do you explain the fact that we just took off these 5 40-foot containers filled with nuclear components on a ship that's docked right now in Tripoli Harbor? He said you could have heard a pin drop. And they called for a recess. 2 or 3 hours later, they came back and they said, you know, you're right. We do have a nuclear program. So they basically, their bluff was called. We had the whole card because we had the convincing evidence that they did have a nuclear program. And very quickly thereafter, Ray and Mr. Steve Kappas and some others all successfully concluded the disarmament of Libya and got all of that equipment out of Libya over the coming few weeks.
So, Jim, how hard was it to penetrate the network?
Well, it's, I have to be a little careful here in what I say, but it's like that movie that where Kevin Costner, The Field of Dreams, we built some entities overseas and we built the playing field and the people came. I could also analogize to an operation that was run by the founder of the Russian intelligence service, the Cheka, which became the KGB and today the SVR and FSB. Felix Dzerzhinsky was faced with an existential challenge in the late 1917-1918 period. The Bolsheviks had seized power through a coup in Moscow, and they were then confronted by the counter-revolutionaries. And Dzerzhinsky decided that in order to defeat the counter-revolutionaries, he would become a counter-revolutionary. And so I took that same concept of defeating proliferators. I had to become a proliferator myself. And so we created certain entities around the world where we held ourselves out as proliferators. And by doing that, we attracted the real proliferators.
That's fascinating, Jim. So just tell us a little bit, at least what you can, about, you know, how did CIA, the U.S. intelligence community, and our close partners, the British, finally sort of take down the network?
So George Tenet, based on the intelligence that we had, he confronted President Musharraf, who was at the UN General Assembly in the fall of 2004, right after, well, actually in the fall of 2003, I'm sorry, right after the seizure of the, or the BBC China had offloaded its components. And he said, you know, Dr. Khan is betraying your nuclear secrets. And Musharraf's reaction was that he wanted to kill Khan, and Mr. Tenet said, no, we don't want you to do that. So instead, President Musharraf forced Dr. Khan to make a confession on TV and then went under house arrest for the next 5 or 6 years. At the same time, we worked with some other governments to basically arrest members of the network and make sure that everything was wrapped up.
So, Jim, what's happened to Khan since then? Do you know?
He passed away about 2 years ago. He, you know, tried to, again, the guy was extremely well connected and still is revered in Pakistan. He tried to, you know, take back his confession. He still had PR folks going on, but we had so utterly destroyed his network that we decided that he was really not much of a danger anymore. And of course, the Pakistani, there had been no love lost between him and President Musharraf. So I could safely say that most of the network, if not all of the network, was shut down.
So Jim, do you think we could see another Khan network today? Obviously not with AQ Khan, but something similar? Or are there protections and tripwires and knowledges in place that would prevent that?
One would hope. However, I'm kind of a realist. And I think that if we were to look around the world, what I would expect if we had another AQ Khan, somebody with almost his unique access to material and plans, it would have to be something like either a rogue Russian general or a rogue Chinese general, somebody who has a lot of power, a lot of access to material and plans. And I you know, I don't know if we have enough, you know, right now with everything else that's going on in Ukraine, it would probably be an ideal time for some rogue general somewhere to, for personal enrichment means, to spirit those plans and everything out of Russia or out of perhaps out of China.
Yeah, that's sobering. You know, success stories like this don't just happen without strong leadership. And you just mentioned Director of CIA George Tenet. So how important was his leadership in taking apart the network? And I guess the second part to that is, what did he do that made a difference to what you were doing?
Well, George Tenet was essential, absolutely essential to the success of this. He, you know, CIA is a big, is a large bureaucracy. There are fiefdoms and unfortunately sometimes petty jealousies between these fiefdoms. But George Tenet always made sure that my team had whatever we needed. He made it one of his top priorities. And he and I, he would come have me come up to his office periodically and give him briefings on things. But I always felt extremely confident that what I was doing would have his full backing. And it did. It had his full backing. George Tenet is a almost, well, he could have been a case officer himself. I've even jokingly told him if I were to ever write his biography, the title would be The Spy Who Loved Us, because he absolutely loved CIA. He loved the Directorate of Operations, the Director of Intelligence, the Directorate of Science and Technology, everybody. He loved it. And he was a natural at this. And so he was essential to providing top cover. He had me brief the president. He had me brief the vice president. And he continued to ask, is there anything you need? At the same time, by the way, my good friend Rolf Moat Larsen was running the Weapon of Mass Destruction Department for Counterterrorist Center. And George Tenet insisted that Rolf and I meet periodically and exchange information to make sure that none of Khan's technology would leak to Al-Qaeda or to any other rogue terrorist organization. Well, this wasn't a hard request since Rolf and I met all the time for lunch and would exchange things, but he wanted absolute transparency between our two units, and we did. We had absolute transparency. I kept Rolf apprised of everything, and he did likewise for me.
Jim, let's just shift a bit of a broader question about espionage, and just maybe we can take advantage of your long and distinguished career as an operations officer. You know, we live in an era of rapid technological change, as you know, amazing surveillance capabilities, and readily available detailed data about every one of us and just about everything. You know, stuff that was sort of unimaginable even a few short years ago. So I guess I have a little bit of a two-part question. Is there still a role for human intelligence today? And are there lessons from the AQ-Khan operation or your career that apply to collection today?
Well, the bottom line answer to that question, Andy, is absolutely there is a room for human intelligence. We have just seen this disaster unfolding in Israel on October the 7th, where unfortunately there were a lot of technical sensors, things all along the border in Gaza. And here we had a almost 1,400, 1,500 Hamas fighters invading Israel. And I can't believe that there was not a single human source among them that could have told Shin Bet or Mossad what was going on. They were training for months. Had they had, you know, extremely good human sources in there, it would have been probably, would have saved 1,000, you know, maybe 1,200 Israeli lives. So becoming over-reliant on technology, I think, is the lead-on to a complete disaster. That's just one small example. We, in the Khan operation, it was a blend of signals intelligence, human intelligence, all the ints that you could possibly think about. I sometimes thought of myself as a symphony conductor. You had the brass, you had the woodwinds, you had the strings, you had the chorus. And I had to know when to bring in the various elements that all of the things that are all at our availability, everything, all these ints, brilliant analysis, all of the things that we needed to defeat the Khan network. And so, and then ultimately, the Trump card was human. And I sound like a hammer that sees only nails, but I really think that human is the key thing. Not to ignore SIGINT, not to ignore all the cyber and other things that we have, the overhead programs and things, but to me, in order to get inside the heads, the plans, intentions, those things aren't, you're not going to hear that in SIGINT. You're not going to see that in a computer a lot of times. Or if it's in there, it may be aspirational, but not really realistic. I've had sources where I've talked to them and they would tell me, here's the documents about it, but let me tell you what's really going on. Because, the documents may be aspirational, they may be something to please a leader, but the people themselves, they know what they're capable of, and they know what's going to go on.
Yeah, Jim, your characterization of a symphony is great. It really is that when you've got various types of collection mixed with the right kind of analysis, you can really get things to work well. So in your books, Jim, I guess along these lines, you raise two concepts, the sacred commitment we make to our clandestine sources and a phrase you use, the metaphysics of recruitment. So given what you just said about the importance of human collection, can you just briefly talk about these two concepts?
Absolutely. Case officers learn early on that when we give a clandestine asset, somebody we recruit, a security commitment, that we mean that with our whole heart. This is a sacred commitment. And in both of my first two books and the third one that I'm working on, the commitment to the security of our assets is absolutely ironclad. We can't guarantee 100% that we can keep them safe, but what we can guarantee 100% is we will try our darndest. We will go to hell and back to save our assets from any kind of peril or harm. Those security guarantees are literally a sacred vow, and my books both demonstrate that. When our assets in Iran get into trouble, or in the second book, the asset in Russia, who's at the heart of a bioweapons program, when he gets into trouble, we'll go to hell and back to get that person out of trouble. This is a vow that we would go out of business if we didn't make that type of commitment. As for the metaphysics of recruitment, this is a concept that is, in fact, metaphysical. It's something that among the best 1 or 2, 3% of operations officers, it's a way to explain how some ops officers can focus on a target. And when they go into their recruitment pitch, it's as if there's an invisible link between the operations officer and the target. I know that when I would go into the pitch myself, you could have explosions going off. You could have fires going off all around us. And neither I nor my target would be able to distinguish that, because I take them into a basically almost like another plane of existence. And it's just them and me. Maybe you can explain that. I have a soothing voice. One asset once told me that when I was talking to him, it was as if his brain was in a warm waterbed. I want to relax the person. It's kind of semi-hypnotic. But there's something I just can't explain, why I could connect with somebody and make them do things that they might otherwise not do. And it's that metaphysical connection that comes through in both my books, and it certainly will be in my third book, The Traitor's Tale.
Jim, thanks. It was great to talk again, and I guess we'll all look forward to your next thriller, The Traitor's Tale. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Andy.
Before we go, let me just highlight some of the feedback that we recently got. Anna wrote, "Hands down, my favorite podcast." Another reviewer on December 21st said, "This is a real welcome addition to my podcast." Thank you for the feedback. Please keep it coming. That was Jim Lawler. I'm Andy McCreadis. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.